On general government. This morning is Monday, May the 9th. We are here this morning to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5025, the Employment Relations Board. And I'm going to ask anyone who is interested in testifying today to be sure to sign up. We are noticed for public testimony. I want to make sure that we have ample opportunity to hear everyone and consequently to help me balance the time. If those of you who are interested in testifying would sign up, that would be very helpful. What I plan to do is to start with the agency overview, do that for about a half an hour, then do a check on public testimony to see who has signed up to make sure we can manage the opportunity for everyone who's come to speak. We're going to take those people who have come from the greatest distance first, and then we'll go back into the agency presentation if we need to finish with the governor's recommendation, and then a chance for the committee to discuss anything that they've heard and ask any questions. So if that's satisfactory to everyone, that's how we're going to proceed. So with that, we'll welcome you this morning, ask you to give your name for the record. And
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, my name is Paul Gamson. I am a member and the chair of the Employment Relations Board, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here this morning and tell you the story about our little agency and hopefully to work with you on some of the budget challenges that we're facing. And I will start off by saying that this is a new process to me. I understand that we're to follow a general outline that we received from the Legislative Fiscal Office, but clearly my goal isn't to simply fulfill an outline. My goal is to give you the information that you need to make what clearly are some difficult choices. So if I'm off track, pull me back in.
Actually, you're right on track, and I think rather than having you go through the outline, it might be useful to talk a little bit about the agency. I'm not sure that all the members of the panel, and I'm confident we'll be joined by our colleagues shortly, have had the opportunity to have heard the presentation from the Employment Relations Board previously. And over the weekend, in anticipation of this meeting, I was doing a little trip down memory lane looking at some old meetings of the E-Board. And one of them was to talk about asking for some audits to be done in the agency. And I think if you wouldn't mind starting with a brief historical overview. You've had a lot of personnel changes, and I think you've suffered mightily under some budget reductions, and maybe you would like to just give us a 100,000-foot overview to kind of set the stage for the rest of your presentation.
I appreciate that. And actually, I think there probably are just the big picture, just three really pretty critical facts. The first is that in the last legislative session, we were cut by 25%, and I would suspect that there weren't very many agencies our size that were cut. We went from 16 people down to 12. We lost four employees, four positions, and it was not a cut out of an agency otherwise marbled with fat, because the larger historical budget perspective is that from approximately the 91-93 biennium, we had 24 employees, and now we're down to 12. So it's been a constant backing off. And I can certainly assure the committee that despite the fact that we lost 25% of the personnel in the agency, we did not have a 25% reduction in our workload. And in fact, if anything, our workload has caseload has remained steady or slightly increased.
Were all of those positions filled with incumbents, or were any of them vacancies?
I believe that actually two of them, although this predated, I really am very new. My understanding is that two people actually had to be laid off, and two were vacant positions that were not subsequently filled. Okay. So the 25% cut is the first fact. The second is, and I think you mentioned it earlier, the level of turnover. In addition to the four people that we lost at the beginning of the biennium, six key people during the biennium out of a 12-person agency have left, and some avowedly key personnel left for the reason that the agency no longer has the resources to carry out its mission. And we certainly have hired competent people to replace them, but, for example, with a 23-year chief administrative law judge experience, you know, I guess there's a saying in the NBA, you can't teach height. Well, you can't teach experience either. So it kind of feels like the canary going down the mine, the fact that people are leaving in such large numbers and such key people, I think, is an indication of something toxic down the mine shaft. And I guess the third kind of big overview point that I wanted to make is that during the last biennium, what really kept us afloat after the 25% cuts were what, in essence, to us was about $200,000 in one-time money, about $53,000 thereabouts from an emergency board action. And I guess if six people leaving was the lemons to the agency, I guess the lemonade was that we had vacancy savings that amounted to almost $150,000. When people left, there were sometimes several months when positions weren't filled, so we didn't have to pay salary, and some of the people that we hired were hired in at lower salaries than the people that were replaced. And what we did with the money was, and I probably will end up, to the extent we talk about the audit, was to update some of our very outdated equipment. But in addition to get clerical assistance, and for much of the biennium anyhow, we've had, I've used that vacancy savings to have another half-time administrative law judge, which means that for much of the biennium, we, in fact, have had 2.5 administrative law judges. And if the governor's recommendation to add an administrative law judge or at least half an administrative law judge isn't followed, we're actually going to go backwards. If what the committee recommends is simply going back to the staffing levels that we had at the beginning of the biennium, it's actually going to be a step backwards for us. I guess the next step is kind of an overview. Who are we and why should you care? And essentially who we are is we're the labor court for the state of Oregon, for public employees in Oregon. We're three full-time board members. I understand that's a little unusual, and I pointed out because the board members are not part-time volunteers. We're full-time board members, and one of them, being me, is appointed by the governor to be the chair, which means I get to come do this and do some administration.
Let's just double check to make sure that everybody understands these are paid positions and full time. This is not a volunteer board.
That's correct.
And you all, there's been some turnover in the board, has there not? And you have become ranking in a rather short period of time. Is that not correct?
I have been in the agency for less than 2 years. I've been chair for nearly a year. Essentially at the beginning of the biennium, two longtime board members essentially resigned. One of their replacements was here for 8 or 9 months thereabouts, and very skilled person, but she decided after seeing the lay of the land that, and she wrote this in a letter of resignation, that the agency no longer has the resources necessary to carry out its mission. So she moved on to something else, and we have hired yet again another new person. So there have been three within the biennium, essentially three board members. Now there is one remaining board member, Rita Thomas, who has been a great help teaching the new people. She's been here, I think, about 7.5, coming up on 8 years, but the rest of us are pretty new.
It might be useful if you wouldn't mind having a copy of the letter of resignation and provide that to the professional staff, and we'll disseminate it to the committee.
I appreciate that. So the agency's mission is essentially to resolve workplace disputes. We focus on public sector, both state and local government, although we have some limited jurisdiction over some private sector employment. There are several thousand employers under our jurisdiction, approximately 200,000 plus employees, and of those 200,000, about 185,000 are public sector employees.
State and local government.
State and local. So school districts, cities, counties, irrigation districts, water districts, fire districts, police, corrections.
So if there's a labor dispute at the county level, and it comes to you, you're paid a fee for service for that adjudication?
There is a modest fee. Let me back up for a second. When I say that our goal, our mission is to resolve disputes, the statute essentially gives us three arrows in our quiver, three essential ways that we resolve disputes, depending on what the dispute is. One is if the dispute, for example, concerns should there be a union in the workplace, we resolve the dispute by an election. If the dispute is between labor and management unable to find common ground to reach a collective bargaining agreement, then we have a dispute resolution procedure through the mediation and conciliation service. And then the third kind, basically for just about all other kinds of disputes, is contested case litigation. So there are modest fees for filing certain kinds of contested case litigations, unfair labor practices. We're one of three states in the whole country that charge any fee at all for filing, and of those three states, we're already the highest of the filing fees. It's $250 to file and $100 to answer, which there's some fee for service, but it's not self-sustaining. The mediation service also charges fees, and in that regard, I think there are, out of the 36 states, I think we're one of two states that charge any fee at all, and we're by far the highest fee in the United States. We charge $1,000, $500 for each side for the mediation.
Last question before I interrupt you. Again, you're trying to soldier through your presentation. I won't leave you alone. What is the ratio between state and local government cases?
It's actually a slightly difficult question because that's not precisely, we're not set up precisely to track it that way, although we are, since I've become chair, we're working to change our accounting so that we can more closely track it. But in some general sense, caseload, Les, I think it was in like 35% state, about 65% local. And it might be a little bit higher local and a little bit lower state, but that's the ballpark.
I'll just conclude with this. Set aside the level of cuts, because that's a whole other question that we've got to come back to. But it seems to me, if I understand what you've said correctly, you're selling below cost to local government and trying to make it up in volume. I mean,
that's right.
So you go broke, Madam Speaker.
Where I come from, that's how you go broke. And so I think that might be something that we'll want to come back and visit again.
Okay.
And I'm just going to ask the professional staff to flag that to come back and chat about it.
Okay. And
your fees are set in statute, I think.
Fees are, and I would note that based on a budget note, I believe, from last time, I inherited three or four budget notes when I became chair. One of the budget notes was for a funding task force. The stakeholders participated. Representative Butler, who, as you know, he's a CPA and has lots of budget expertise, was gracious enough to participate. And after several meetings and reams of information and material, the general conclusion was keep things about as they are. We weren't looking at funding levels. We were looking at the mechanism to raise fees or not. There was discussion of a whole variety of different ways to fund the agency, and the task force recommendation was essentially to keep things the way they are, although to look at fees if that becomes necessary. Okay.
To continue, and I'll try to exercise some restraint here.
I actually quite appreciate am here to answer your questions and to make sure you have the information you need, so I appreciate that. I guess I'll continue a little bit with the agency overview. We administer three separate statutory schemes. One is the public or the private sector collective bargaining law. It's a fairly minor aspect of what we do. Most private sector, meaning non-government employers, are covered by the federal law, except for some few that are either too small economically or don't have enough impact on interstate commerce to be covered by the federal law, and we do maybe a handful of those cases at most in a year. The second is the state personnel relations law, which is essentially a civil service board for the state of Oregon, for management service employees and for classified employees who are not part of the collective bargaining units. And in that regard, we hear appeals from virtually any kind of a personnel action. We hear a variety of issues ranging from discipline, classification and pay disputes, layoffs, terminations, and the like. And we get and when I talk about our caseloads, they vary somewhat year to year, but there's not a huge fluctuation. We get something in the neighborhood of 25 or so of those cases a year, but I would point out that they can tend to be really quite complex cases with long hearing records and long hearings. And then the third statute that we administer is the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, and that's where most of our business comes from. It's the collective bargaining law that covers state and local government employees, and we have maybe in the range of 100 to 125 cases a year, plus another 80 to 100 mediation cases a year. I think I already talked a little bit. We do contested case hearings, we conduct elections, we provide mediation services. We issue declaratory rulings, we review arbitration awards and the like. So that's essentially what we do, and I'd like to take a second. I guess I labeled it "Why Should You Care?" But a couple of reasons. Partly is because it's important to the people who are in the room today. Public employees, both on management and labor side. We have, you know, teachers that we entrust our kids to, and public safety officers, police and fire and corrections, who risk their lives every day to keep us safe. The blue-collar employees who build our roads and maintain our parks and deliver safe drinking water to us, and clerical and office staff who we all know run essentially everything. So it's important to them. A second reason why we're important is that we help avert work stoppages, strikes, and other kinds of work stoppages, which cost public employers and employees fairly dearly in some cases, and they disrupt services to the public. We're important because we are having a way to resolve disputes in the workplace creates stability in the workplace. A stable workplace means, and it actually feels ironic that I'm about to say this after telling you about all the turnover, but in our agency, but a stable workforce tends to not have a lot of turnover, to save money on recruitment and training, and it actually has an economic development component. If you listen to the sound bites of the large companies that talk about relocating in Oregon, they will virtually always say that one of the factors they look at is stable and reliable public services. So the stability that we help create, I think, goes towards that. We're important in resolving workplace disputes because if there isn't a way to resolve those kind of disputes, they tend to sit and fester. And when there's festering disputes, employees are distracted, managers have to deal with it, and in the best case scenario, distracted employees are productivity, you know, it's a productivity issue, it's a work quality issue, but in the worst case scenario, if we're talking about a school bus driver, a police officer, a corrections officer, it actually becomes a public safety issue. So resolving disputes kind of keeps the workplace clear and keeps things moving. And perhaps the last reason that I want to talk about now is because if we didn't exist, a lot of the cases, most of the cases that we hear would end up in state and actually particularly in federal courts. which in the long run would be far more expensive to state and local government than having us. So I've talked in some general way about the cuts, tried to describe a little bit about what we do. Let me give you some really specific examples about how the cuts have cut so deeply into the just the absolutely basic things that we do, in addition to the personnel cuts. When the board in particular and administrative law judges are deciding cases, I mean, essentially they do two things. They decide the facts and they decide the law. It's the facts, what happened, who's telling the truth, who's not. And we have to determine what the law is, and then we apply the law to the facts and reach a conclusion in the case. But our two main tasks are facts and law. And the two basic tools, one for determining facts and one for determining law, we don't have. For the law, we're a precedent-based body, which essentially means that we have to do legal research and look at prior cases and apply them. And in recent years, and we've had a library, but in recent years, we've had to stop getting the necessary research materials. It would be as though, as legislators, you folks didn't have access to legislative counsel and didn't have access to the kinds of materials that you need, because you would then end up having to write your own laws. It's just a basic lack of the most fundamental tools of the trade. Now, in the last couple of months, I've been able to purchase, I think it's about $400 a month, online computer research services, but I've done that out of the vacancy savings, and there's no guarantee. It's not built into the upcoming budget for the next biennium, and there's no guarantee that we're going to have that, so that is an ongoing issue. So that's the legal side. The factual side, the most basic piece of equipment, the most basic thing that we use is transcripts. We have transcripts of hearing. We can read what people say. Now, by law, we're required to make a record of all the hearings that we do, and the way we make our record is right now on audio tape. We're going to get some better digital equipment. But we record it, and then in the past, we had always had it transcribed so that we can sit and read when necessary to determine what the facts of the case are. And I can tell you that every case, every court, certainly in this state, and I think everywhere in the United States, has transcripts. And as far as I can tell, every agency that is like us, the Public Utilities Commission, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Workers' Compensation, all of the other agencies that conduct contested case hearings have the availability of transcripts, and we don't. And as a consequence, what happens is that if, for example, there is an eight-day hearing, the three board members, instead of being able to quickly read through the transcript, have to actually in real time sit and listen. If it's an eight-day hearing, it's an eight-day listening. And one of the things that happens is on the seventh day, you'll hear something that says, now, is that consistent with what I heard on the second day? And then you have to go back, and I can tell you from really grim experience, it can take hours to go back and find that one little piece to be able to compare. You know, we have to make credibility determinations, and if somebody on the second day said the light was green and somebody on the seventh day said the light was red, we need to look precisely at what they said. Did they say it was green turning to yellow? I mean, we need to go back and look at that and being able to find it. I can tell you that this, the lack of transcripts is a huge impediment to our productivity. It's essentially we sit as a board and you're paying us to listen to tapes rather than for 8 days rather than being able to sit down and read it in, you know, maybe a day.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, how long have you been without transcripts?
The entire time that I've been with the board, which is not quite 2 years, we stopped. My understanding is that it stopped essentially right at the outset of the biennium. Now, I don't want to mislead anybody. We do have a slight amount of money, a small amount of money for transcription services, but we have to use that money because when one of our cases gets appealed to the Court of Appeals requires a transcript, so we have to purchase a transcript. And, of course, we don't know in advance which cases are going to be appealed, so transcripts are made of some cases, but not in a fashion that's useful to us. It's useful to the Court of Appeals, but it's not done until after we're done. So just so there's no misunderstanding, we do have a small amount of money for transcripts, but almost all of it goes to paying for Court of Appeals transcripts, and we don't have that available to us.
Representative Krupp, then Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why the reason that you have been, the transcription specialist, for lack of a better term, is because of the 2002 budget reductions?
That's my understanding. The two of the positions that were cut, and I believe Chair Johnson asked if they were filled, but two of the positions that were cut, my understanding is one, I believe, was a full-time transcriptionist, and the other had some part-time transcriptionist duties. And my understanding is, though, even though the positions weren't filled at the time, the money for those positions were being used to purchase transcripts. So essentially the answer is we don't have transcripts because of the personnel cuts from last time.
And Madam Chair, one of the recommendations in the narrative here was the e-board in January of 2004 requested an audit, and I'm assuming you'll be talking in depth about the audit at some point here.
Yes, certainly, if I'm directing, if that's of interest to you, yes.
It is, and we'll ask you
to. All right. I'll just hold my question.
Thank you. Senator Morissette. Representative Avakian.
And just a couple questions, if I may. I want to go back to the legal research part of this, because this is an unbelievable thing, and I want to make sure that everyone in the committee understands exactly what you're saying. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the case law that you need to rely on in order to make your decisions is federally based.
It's
at least partially.
At least partially, because the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act is modeled after the federal law. Actually, the Oregon Supreme Court has told us that for that reason we need to take into account federal law.
So when you're drafting a decision after you've had a hearing, I'm just like any judge would, you're going to write an opinion and you're going to support your opinion based on other cases, correct?
That is correct, yes.
In order to do that, you need to know what other cases are being decided. You can't rely on law books that are 15 years old that are sitting on the shelves. Is that right?
That is correct. We would have a very high reversal rate were we to do that.
And you have not had the ability to do that kind of research to know what current cases are being decided around the country or in Oregon?
Well, certainly not in the office. I mean, we have to trundle off to some pretty far-flung libraries that have the collections that we need in order. So every time something comes up, we have to run off to the library. We come back, and inevitably when you come back, you realize there's two more cases that you need to get. So it's, yes.
That is stunningly inefficient.
I do not disagree with you.
Not just inefficient, but and not the use of my word incompetent is no reflection on the job you're doing, which is heroic in some measures. But nobody in the world decides cases this way. Everybody has access to current statutes and current cases. You can get it right over the internet through LexisNexis. It just costs some money. And the fact we put people in a powerful position of authority that doesn't have access to those kind of basic tools is amazing.
I think we're going to come back and cover that in the audit, because I will expect that you're going to share with us that the audit revealed these kinds of glaring deficiencies in your office. But in the interest of time management, we now have 2, 4, 6 people signed up to testify. I will once again invite anyone else who is interested in testifying. We picked up the sheet. Anyone else interested, we'll put it back. Okay, that being the case, Mr. Gamson, I'm going to interrupt you. I feel an obligation to make sure people that have made the effort to come have the opportunity to speak. And so we're going to do testimony. I'm going to limit everybody to no more than 5 minutes. If you can do it more efficiently than that, that would be great. And so for the next 30 minutes, we're going to take testimony. We'll start with Allison Hassler. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Johnson and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify here. For the record, my name is Allison Hassler, and I'm legal counsel for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. I've been practicing law in front of the Labor or the Employment Relations Board for a little over 10 years now. I've watched as, in that 10 years, as the staffing has reduced and reduced and reduced, and I've seen the effects that it's had in the workplace. AFSCME represents about 21,000 employees, public employees mainly. Of those, over 2,000 are employees of the Department of Corrections. We represent corrections officers and all other employees in 9 institutions and a transport unit. It's probably one of, working in the prisons is probably one of the roughest working environments imaginable, and the opportunity for disputes between management and the employees is high, and it's really important to get things quickly resolved there, and that's just not happening anymore. And as Mr. Gamson said, what happens when, in our case, we may file an unfair labor practice against the Department of Corrections for doing something that we believe is wrong, for discriminating against employees for the union activity, or not allowing them representation in investigations. And if that drags on for a year, 2 years, that tension stays there. Probably one of the worst cases I've seen is AFSCME filed an unfair labor practice against a small state agency in July of 2003. We do not yet have a decision on that. And those folks call me. They call me about every 2 weeks, and they want to know, you know, what's happening. And the dispute is still festering. They're still mad at their bosses. And it's just, they just need resolution. Whether win or lose, they need some kind of resolution. That's just not happening, and it just keeps getting worse. The other thing that is so valuable from the Employment Relations Board, and again, I'm going to use the example of our corrections officers, is they are currently bargaining a successor agreement for their collective bargaining agreement. And bargaining with the Department of Corrections and with corrections officers is very tough work. It tends to go too long, particularly since they're spread out all over the state. And we depend very heavily on the mediators. I don't think that we have ever settled a contract in correction without the aid of a mediator. Now, another example outside the state sector is about a year ago, the employees of Coos County came within 4 hours of striking. And it would have been a very damaging strike for the county and for the employers, the employees. And the only way it was settled 4 hours before striking was with one of the state mediators. And it's getting to be a longer and longer time between filing for mediation and actually getting a mediator. And again, you've got that tension that's just festering. Now, the whole issue of transcripts, this is something that affects me. It affects the attorneys for the state, the attorneys for local governments, because if objections get filed on an unfair labor practice or even on a unit clarification, you know, it's been 6 months since you did that, and then you can't remember, so we end up sitting and listening to tapes, and it's a waste of my time, it's a waste of the Attorney General's time, it's a waste of the attorneys in the local government's time. I'm just about done with that. I hope you understand how important it is to have an effective Employment Relations Board, and I will entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions from Ms. Hassler? Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll ask Thomas Gunn to come forward, please.
Morning, Mr. Gunn.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Gunn, and I am the employee relations manager from Marion County. That means I'm the employer's advocate, and I deal with four different unions that represent the majority of the workforce in Marion County. Mr. Avakian may remember me. I was also a member of the Workers' Compensation Board from 1991 to 1996. As the people in the union would tell you, I would not be here to testify in favor of restoring this budget if there wasn't some employer's interest at stake. And to give you some idea of that interest and why I'm here to testify, we have a unit clarification case that started back in September. And that was with SEIU, and Mr. Rosenblatt was there. And at the end of the hearing, the administrative law officer, where we're trying to figure out the briefing schedule, said, well, pick a date, any date you want, because I have a hearing every week for the next 4 months, which was a pretty clear message to us that we probably weren't going to get a decision for at least 4 months. In my previous time when I was advocating at the Employment Relations Board, this hearing would normally be out in 30 days. And to give you some idea of that administrative law judge's workload, as either a union advocate or a management advocate, the worst I ever had was 12 hearings in a year. She was going to be doing 16 hearings in a period of 4 months. Needless to say, we didn't get our decision until just recently. The union has appealed that decision, and we probably won't get an answer, given the workload, probably for another 3 or 4 months at the very earliest. And that means I've got a group of at least 30% of these folks who filed for this petition for election who are unhappy and want to know whether or not they're going to have a right to vote in an election. I got a notice today that the Deputy Sheriff's Union has filed an unfair labor practice. And what I find amusing is that we are also in contract negotiations with this group, and we will probably settle the contract before we settle this unfair labor practice. And again, that just leads to the agitation they talked about. The other reality is, as are the employer's representatives, most often the person with the liability arising out of any of these contested cases is going to be the employer. We're the ones that every day we're waiting for a decision, our liability is just building. So it's not in our interest to have a more inefficient process which leads to slower decisions and later decisions, because all that does is increase our liability. For all those reasons, I ask that the committee consider restoring the money to ERB, which will at least help us try to keep stem it from getting any worse. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. In light of these deficiencies, would local government be willing to step up with and backfill with some kind of a fee assessment?
I know that they've talked about it. I personally have always been in favor of a fee assessment, because the assessment is right now what they use for the state. And frankly, they can't raise the fees high enough to sustain funding. So the only thing they could do is if they have some type of assessment system. For example, when I was on the board, the Workers' Compensation Board, we were covered under an assessment in the insurance companies, and I had legal staff that did my research that Paul would probably drool about hearing, you know. And so I think it has to be assessment overall, though. I think it has to be assessment on both the governments involved with the special districts and the counties, the cities, and also an assessment on the unions. That's my personal choice.
Other questions for Mr. Gunn?
Thank you very much for coming, sir. I would invite up Llewellyn Nelson, please.
Good morning, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Llewellyn Nelson. I'm a full-time arbitrator and mediator, which I've done for most of the last 19 years. Before that, I spent 10 years with the National Labor Relations Board, which is the federal counterpart to the Employment Relations Board here, and which administers the statute on which the ERB bases much of its decisions, or at least refers to in many of its decisions. But probably the major reason that I'm here today is that I am the infamous 10-month member who resigned when I realized that the resources for this agency were insufficient for it to be able to do its job properly. In the right sort of world, I wouldn't be here asking you not to cut $200,000 from the agency's budget. I would be here asking you to add the positions back to the agency that it really needs in order to do its functions appropriately. It was astonishing to me when I came to the agency on September 1 of 2003 and discovered that I had better computer equipment and scanner and printer at home than the agency had in its offices, and I had been funding that as a sole practitioner, self-employed arbitrator, and mediator.
May I interrupt you for just a second? Sure. Just to, I guess, to put Mr. Gamson sort of on notice that I want to come back and visit this. My little bitty office has Westlaw and all sorts of stuff available to it. I'm trying to figure out, you walked in the door on day one and looked around and said, wow, these guys are missing some essential tools that basically a law office, a professional functioning law office, would have.
Yes.
You can't have been the first person that said, where's the LexisNexis? And I'm trying to figure out how far back the deficiencies in the technical support stuff existed, and when did somebody start screaming about it?
It's my understanding that it started being cut when unfortunately this body started nibbling away at the agency's funding a number of years before I ever got there. By the time I got there, they had already cut substantially into bone.
So there had been LexisNexis and it was shut off?
I don't think they'd ever had LexisNexis.
Well, or a LexisNexis-like creature.
I think that they, as I understand, they mostly relied on the printed copies of the legal research tools. There are several entities like the Bureau of National Affairs that issue volumes that report decisions at the federal and state levels, and they have the agency had copies of those up to a certain point, and that point was sometime before I started at the board. And so after that, we got our exercise by wandering down to the nearest law library that had current volumes in it, or I might do it if I was working at home that day. I would go down to the Multnomah County Law Library and find them there, but I couldn't find them in the office in Salem.
You raised two interesting questions, and I'm not sure, given the short tenure of Mr. Gamson, and I don't mean this as a criticism to you, sir, but I'm trying to figure out, somewhere there's got to be a management issue of a law office to look around and find that the basic tools that you run a law office with don't exist. And the second thing that you said is days that you worked at home. Is that a regular practice of the board to be in the office or to be at home, or...?
I telecommuted either one or two days a week, and was able, because I could get some online legal research from my office at home, was able to be at least as effective at home. I also had a copy of the board's own specific case law in my office at home. Because the board staff had been cut so much, there were extra copies of the board's decision volumes that I was able to take one set of those home with me and work from home, and so that allowed me to in some ways be more efficient than being in the office, because the law library for me is closer than the one in Salem, and so often what I would do is, or what I might do is, take a morning, go to the law library in Multnomah County, and then perhaps come into the office in the afternoon, or vice versa.
Thank you.
I wanted to address a couple of things. One is, by the time I got there, the four positions had already been removed. They had just laid off one administrative law judge and one clerical, and the two open positions had not been filled, so there were already no transcripts and so forth. All of the other things that Paul went through. And when I looked around the agency, I had to reflect on my time with the NLRB, which did a similar function. In fact, I spent 5 years working for a board member of the NLRB, so I was doing a piece of the work that at the ERB the board members do themselves. And I was astonished that we had no clerical support. Fortunately, I type. I know how to use a computer. I can format things myself. But if I needed anything done of a clerical nature, I did it myself. That's not efficient, and it's not because any chair of the agency has been frittering away money on something else, that the agency is inefficient. The agency has not been provided with the funds that it needed to do its job. Certainly, I, in developing my self-employment practice, had times in my early years when I couldn't afford to have the tools that would make me efficient, and I had to hope that my practice caught up before the inefficiencies involved in not having my own tools sent my practice down the tubes. Fortunately, I was able to make that up. The agency does not have the ability to grow its practice, if you will. Growing its practice is not even necessarily a good option. And in fact, in that regard, I would like to address the question of fees. I hadn't intended to do that when I got here, but I think that there is a misperception that you could fund this agency's operations if you just make local governments pay high enough fees for using the agency. The problem with that is that it is much like asking the homeowner to pay a fee before a police officer will come and investigate a burglary at the home, or perhaps to fund fully the paving of the street outside their home. There are certain central functions that need to be done, and that it is not good government to have individually funded by the user. The problem, and it's an endemic problem throughout dispute resolution, is that the people who need dispute resolution most are the ones least likely to pay for it when they need to pay for it. There used to be an oil change company that had a slogan, "You can pay me now or you can pay me later." A lot of people put off paying now, thinking that they will never have to pay later. But the agency, when I was there, or very shortly before I got there, I believe it was, had a really good example of an entity, a local government entity, and a union that decided not to use the mediators, wound up in a huge fight over closing their police force of the local entity. With mediation, they might well have been able to resolve some of their issues and been able to avoid that. They ultimately were ordered by the board to reinstitute their police force. It cost the local entity vast sums of money to re-implement a function that they should never have eliminated. Had they spent the money up front to get some mediation in, or had they been able to get an earlier decision from the board before they sank resources into other alternatives, they would have saved more money than it would ever have cost to go to the board. But people will not pay several thousand dollars to come to an agency. They think they can solve the problem themselves, and they often can't.
But that's a business decision. That has nothing to do with the... I mean, a couple of thousand dollars for local government is a de minimis amount of money. They made a business decision not to use mediation, it sounds like.
Well, it may be a de minimis amount. It may seem like a de minimis amount of money, but if you're talking about a small community in eastern Oregon, I'm from Madras. I actually was born, spent my childhood years in Burns. $2,000 isn't a de minimis amount for some of the smaller communities in eastern Oregon, and those are the communities where it's most expensive for the agency to provide the services that it can provide, because they have to send somebody there. They can't come from our administrative law judge or a mediator can't come from their home, be there, and be back home that night. They have hotel costs. They have travel costs. So the agencies that cost the most the entities that cost the most money to service are the ones least able to pay for that service. But there may yet be a large impact on the citizens of those small communities when things go bad because they didn't get timely dispute resolution, and they wind up having to assess their local citizens for or deny other services to their local citizens in order to pay for a problem that could have been resolved had this agency been able to provide the services that it was set up to provide, but that it's not being funded to provide.
Does that conclude your testimony?
That concludes my testimony.
Any questions for Ms. Nelson? You were asked about the question of local government participating, and I think answered that very comprehensively. How about union participation?
As I understand it, and I'm not an expert on the agency's budget. Mercifully, I escaped ever being chair in my 10 months. But the fees are assessed to both sides. So whoever files an unfair labor practice charge pays an initial $250 fee. Whoever responds to that charge pays $100. In mediation, each side pays $500 to come in the door.
Thank you. I will tell you
that $500 is 10 times what the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service charges private employers and unions for the same function to get cases mediated. And that's because the federal government has recognized that that getting cases resolved in mediation is far more efficient than having them continue to suffer.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to apologize in advance. I am unable to read the handwriting. Tim Fan?
Fow.
Fow, I apologize. Thank you. Thank you very much. And given that I've struggled with your name, and I apologize again, if you could spell it for the benefit of the staff.
T-F-A-U.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Tim Fowl, and I work for AFSCME Council 75. I oversee negotiation and enforcement of about a dozen state, county, and municipal contracts. They fall under the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act and the jurisdiction of IRB. And I oppose any cuts in the IRB budget. I actually agree with Ms. Nelson that in a better world we'd be increasing it. There's been a lot of testimony for all the appropriate theoretical legal reasons. The public's well served by an adequately staffed IRB, and there's no replacement for a neutral, skilled third party when dispute resolution is necessary. And I support that testimony. I support that role. But I'd like to tell you today briefly about a less acknowledged role that IRB and its employees fill. And it's the most likely role to be cut if frills have to go away. And I base that not on my guesswork, but watching what's happened to IRB over the last 10 years. And it's going to leave us poorer. I think any cuts here are penny-wise, pound-foolish. The role of mediation services as a trainer of bargaining teams pays huge dividends that are unnoticed. Last year, we had to enter into negotiations with Community Services Consortium in Corvallis. That is a ORS 190, an organization formed by three counties working together, Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln. It's a remarkable organization. It's entirely grant-funded and provides what I'll characterize as anti-poverty programs to the citizens of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln. They include housing rehabilitation, Head Start services, employment retraining, alternative education, even food cleaning, and a lot of other services that help the poorest people in these three counties return to something like personal stability and security. And we had a huge problem. The PERS reforms that were passed a couple of years ago left the employees of this agency unable to retire because the agency does not participate in Social Security. Whatever Social Security eligibility they had earned elsewhere or through spouses was lost through a provision in federal statutes called the governmental pension offset. Any money that they would get from Social Security would be taken away up to the limit of their PERS retirement. This agency functions on the narrowest budget and funding constraints I've seen in 10 years of bargaining at the county level. They get it accomplished through efficiency of management and the dedication of employees. They're really remarkable. But we were looking at a situation where the agency was through. The employees could not continue to work if it meant 30 years and then they retire to become clients of the agency. The agency absolutely could not find any way to fund the additional expenses of Social Security. It was a classic lose-lose. The employees may or may not have struck, but they were going to quit. They had to. It was financial suicide not to. The agency would have had to close to meet those demands. Well before bargaining started, we turned to IRB for help. And the mediation services sent out trainers that we paid fees for, and they trained both teams in a mutual setting on a concept called interest-based bargaining. Instead of exchanging proposals, we learned to define the problem and core interests that had to be met, and how to exchange good faith efforts to fix it, to fail, to try, to fail, to try. Ultimately, we got there. Now, that was a success that wasn't even a blip in the local media. But the failure would have been a disaster for all three counties. Services that their most needy citizens relied on would have gone away. Now, we worked hard. We made a lot of sacrifices. There was a lot of personal growth at the table. But if we didn't have the tools that Herb gave us, it wouldn't have happened. I would ask you not to throw this asset away to save what amounts to pocket change in the overall state budget.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions for this witness? Thank you for coming, and thank you for your written testimony. I will invite now Mr. Rosenblatt, Joel Rosenblatt. Did I do okay on your name?
Well, so, Rosenblatt.
I'm going to ask you to spell your name for the staff, please.
R-O-S-E-N-B-L-I-T.
Thank
Rosenblatt.
You.
I'm Joel Rosenblatt. I'm the lead attorney for SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent over 35,000 workers, 16,000 state of Oregon workers, and some local government workers. Home care workers, which are covered by the Employment Relations Board, and some workers who are covered by the NLRB, not by the Employment Relations Board. We've been severely harmed by the delays that occur at ERB through no fault of their own because of the understaffing. I'm the counterpart to Tom Gunn on the Marion County case he was talking about. It's an organizing campaign of temporary employees, and we waited 7 months for the judge to issue a decision. And this is in a representation case that leads to an election. And it's an election for temporary employees, and they're turning over all the time. So essentially, we have to organize new employees as the employees turn over, as we're waiting for a board decision. And that case, after 7 months before the judge, and the judge issued a decision, we're waiting now for a board decision, and we could wait a long time for a board decision. When we had an organizing campaign among state temporary workers, we had to wait 9 months for a decision from the board, and that's a long period of time in a representation case. So we would like to see things speed up, and the only way for things to speed up is to give them the resources they need and to increase the staffing at the board, which has been severely depleted over the years, as you've heard. It also hurts us in the cases that we file. Actually, this was a case that was filed by the state to appeal an arbitrator's decision, which is one of the powers that the board has. Arbitration's intended to be final and binding, but there are exceptions, and there is an appeal mechanism that the board deals with. But arbitration is supposed to be quick, and people are supposed to get decisions, and when an arbitration decision is appealed, we would like a quick decision on that appeal. And we had a case recently that took over a year, and the DOJ attorney was complaining to the board that it was taking so long, and we were complaining too. But once again, I don't think it's the fault of the board after hearing about how their resources have been so depleted. We had to wait a long time. I had to listen to my DOJ counterpart complain about this box that she was always tripping over in her office, which was the record of this case. We both wanted that to be done, and they did issue a decision recently. It was after 15 months. I'm beginning to think, why do I have a right to complain? Because I heard about Allison Hassler testifying about a case that she's been waiting 2 years on. And the facts are that the board's caseload is going up. Their staffing is going down. It makes no sense, but I realize it's that you have difficult budget decisions to make and have to allocate resources, but we think you should be allocating more resources to the board. When the board does have resources, they're efficient. They try to do the best they can without the resources now. We had a very unusual election for home care workers. You may know about the home care workers who take care of our elderly and disabled citizens. And they work individually in homes. So this had to be a mail ballot election with one worker at each work site, basically. And it was a logistical nightmare for the board to get out 13,000 ballots. And then they had to count all those ballots. And I'll never forget that counting day when all hands were on deck. We had judges counting ballots. We had mediators counting ballots. Everybody was there helping out. So they do all pitch in and try to get the job done. I'm just astonished and appalled that they don't have transcripts to work with, that they don't have the clerical support to work with. I don't know how I would get my job done without my legal assistant in my office, the clerical support that I have. It's just essential when you're operating in the legal field. And they don't have the legal research tools that we have in our office. So it's incredible to me that they do the good job that they do with without the resources that they need. They're also in the OARs, in the Oregon Administrative Rules, there are certain procedures to expedite cases on because decisions are needed very rapidly. These involve deciding whether subjects, whether when parties are bargaining, there are certain subjects that they must bargain about. There are other subjects that they can bargain about that are permissive subjects of bargaining, and other subjects that they can't bargain about. When the parties are disputing whether something is a mandatory subject of bargaining, IRB is supposed to make a decision very rapidly according to the Oregon Administrative Rules. I believe it's 45 days. Or when the parties have a dispute about bargaining, any other kind of dispute about bargaining, there's an expedited procedure. We were told by the board, we'll try to meet the timelines in the OARs, but we can't make you any promises. And that's just because their resources are low. So when the parties need quick decisions, they can't always get them. And we think it's essential that you provide the ERB with the resources they need to do the job that both management and labor needs for them to get done, and at least don't cut their budget if you can't increase their budget.
You've made a very compelling case for additional resources, and I would ask you, in this very fiscally constrained environment that we're operating in right now, where would you suggest to this panel that they find the money?
Well, I haven't done an analysis of the Oregon state budget. You know, I'm not one who believes that there's a lot of fat in government, and everybody's working very hard. I'm going to decline to answer that question, particularly because I don't want to point out any of the folks that we represent as areas that you should cut. But no, I leave that to you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, then Senator Morris.
Okay, I guess the other way of asking the question is, how much does the lack of resources contribute to the cost of this? That's the other way of looking at it, because if we don't spend the money up front, we're going to spend it somewhere else.
That's a good, very good point,
yeah.
Senator.
So
it's penny wise and pound foolish, right? You save money today, but it costs more money in the long run. If we don't get our disputes resolved and they fester, it usually leads to more disputes.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With all due respect to our witness and all of you present, I take great exception to this hearing today. There was a budget note that was written in the last budget that required IRB to develop a funding mechanism. You have held three meetings, and the statement that we have in our workup here, and this is why I'm a little agitated, if general fund support proved to be insufficient, the work group seemed to prefer the status quo rather than reconfiguring or increasing fees. I don't understand, if this issue is of such great importance, which it obviously is, to both parties, labor and management, how a status quo recommendation could be forthcoming when we have such dysfunctional and inefficient operations. in this general fund limited environment. And it's just baffling to me, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm just baffled how you could allow this to come and then expect us to adjudicate an issue that you can't come to agreement on, but save for a recommendation of status quo. And I apologize for the rather sharp tone of my remarks, but I don't understand why we're at this point here today.
Well, Senator, I understand that local governments aren't paying as much as state agencies under the current system. That's what I've heard this morning, and certainly I think local governments should be paying their share. The union pays the bulk of the fees because we file the bulk of the unfair labor practices, we pay our $250 every time we file, and we're, you know, if you decide to increase fees, we'll pay more fees because we need the job to be done. You know, those fees obviously come out of our members' pockets. They come out of dues revenue, and we don't like to spend that money on fees for ERB, but we'll spend it, and if you decide to increase the fees, we'll spend that too. Or if you'd like to place fees in other areas. It's kind of a shock to me to pay fees because I used to be an NLRB agent for 8 years, and the NLRB doesn't charge any fees. So I come into this environment and find out that fees have been instituted in 1995. But we pay them. We're not happy to pay them, but we pay them and we'll continue to pay them. And if you raise them, we'll pay the raised fees because we need the services.
Senator Morse, I think you may have the chance to visit with Jim Green from the Oregon School Boards Association, who was a member of the committee and has signed up on the witness list to testify. Please ask your next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a follow-up to the comments, as I read the data, there's approximately $250,000 per biennium that's generated by fees. The rest of it's by general fund and $1.35 per month assessment. Now, is that $1.35 a month per assessment directly to the unions, or is that to the agencies per employee and they pay it?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, it is per employee to state agencies.
So the agencies pay for that?
For the state portion of the assessment.
Right, which would then, follow up, Madam Chair, which would then be indirectly from general funds and other funds, federal funds, fees, and assessments.
That is correct.
So
we pay the filing fee.
The point I'm making is the filing fee represents probably less than 10% of the budget to provide these services. So it's a rather small amount of the total funding. And then the general fund assessment for the local governments, of course, that represents there's $1,556,000 of general fund and $256,000 of other funds. So local government is being subsidized by the general fund. So, Madam Chair, I apologize for being a little bit frustrated, and I apologize to all the members present, but I find it highly unusual for such a pressing problem to come from you folks without a recommended solution.
I think we'll have a chance to visit with Mr. Gamson about that, Representative McCaughey.
And when Mr. Gamson comes up or Mr. Green, whoever wants, what I'm hearing both from that note and from a couple of the people that testified is that the status quo relates only to whether or not fees should be increased or money should come from some source other than the state of Oregon. And the theme I've heard from a couple folks is that if the state is going to have this charge that this agency exists and provide a service to governments or citizens or unions or whoever, that it's the state's obligation to come up with a revenue stream that funds the programs that it puts out, similar to our court system, where we have a court system in order to solve disputes, and we find a revenue stream in order to do that, partially based on nominal fees that people could pay, but not entirely dependent on that. So I don't know, as folks testify, maybe you will want to be a little bit clearer about what your perception is with regard to where the obligation lies.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to reverse the order of these and ask Mr. Green to come forward with Mr. Tucker's permission, given that we've moved into this area of discussion, and then Randy Tucker will be next. And if anyone else is moved to want to testify, we'll make sure that the sheet gets back down there just so that I can manage the time. Good morning, Mr. Green.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. And first let me address just our general overall comments, then I'll get to the point that Senator Morris brought up and the task force recommendations that came out of a budget note out of last biennium's budget for the Employment Relations Board. First and foremost, the Oregon School Boards Association supports the agency's request for additional funding for its positions for the administrative law judge to get back transcription services. I don't practice in this area, but we have several bargainers on staff who have told me, you know, one of the most frustrating things they have is when they've got to appeal a case, they don't have transcription services. They've got to sit there and listen to the tape, and that the research facilities aren't the best at ERB. So we're here in support of that. One of the things I did want to point out, and since Senator Morris brought it up, there was a ERB funding task force that was formed out of a budget note on their budget from last biennium. And as the chair has indicated, I was a member of that task force. I think there were 10 of us. And I don't know, did the subcommittee receive the full report?
Yes, we have.
Okay. And if you take a look at that, there was a lot of information brought forward. I don't know if you got the whole packet of information, but Paul Gamson, the chair, brought forward a lot of information on how other states do this, and it was a pretty good representation of folks across both employers and employees representing both sides that have come together and said, look, we need to fund this agency. And what we said originally in the task force recommendation was we need to fund this agency from state general fund dollars, and I think Representative Avakian has made a pretty good case about it. You don't want to have this agency funded by one side or the other. They are like a judicial tribunal in that they decide cases. There are three members of the board, one who's neutral, one who's from labor, and one who's from management. But one of the ideas that was put forward was, well, let's just put a per-employee assessment on local governments. As you've heard already, for small jurisdictions, that could be problematic. For large jurisdictions, that could be problematic. But you want to have an independent ERB board here. And remember that the way that this agency was created and the things they're charged with are created by you here at the legislature. When we have a labor dispute, we're guided in statute that we go to ERB. And we believe it's a state responsibility to fund this. Now, the task force delved into the other issues. If there's not enough general fund money, and Representative Butler, who was a member of that task force, kept pounding on us, hey, if there's not enough money, this task force needs to make recommendations. And there were recommendations made, and I will tell you that it was in some areas there was agreement. There were also ones where there were significant disagreement from employees and employers that served on the task force. And I did make the motion, which eventually became the task force recommendation, and there was divergent on the last point, and I'll bring those up for you right now and highlight them. We said, first, it's a state role. We should state fund this. If that's not available, then we need to take a look at user fees for the system. That should be equally split among employers and employees, not just a per-head tax on employers across the state. That we have a lot of small school districts, the entities that I represent, that don't take advantage of ERB. So why would you want to assess a fee on them when they don't access the services that come forward from ERB? The other one dealt with, you heard earlier from Mr. Gamson, kind of a broad overview of the agency. They have some NLRB responsibilities where they do private issues of private employers that don't have Commerce Clause impact. And we said, boy, for those agencies, why aren't those parties paying the full boat for the cost of those services? And that was one of the recommendations from the task force. One of the recommendations from the task force that did not get agreement across the board, and I'll tell you it was controversial, was you heard about a very highly charged election for home services. And employers made a motion at the task force that said elections for union representation don't affect employers. That affects employees and affects public employee unions. That should be part of that. I will tell you that that passed with employers voting aye and employee representatives voting no on that issue at the task force. We also talked about that if ERB would put its decisions online, much like a Westlaw or a LexisNexis or what have you, that's a very valuable tool. And if one side has it, as you know, when you get into this area or in the areas of law, the other side needs that tool as well. It's a fee for service that they could charge for to get that out there. Obviously, to get their opinions online takes some initial upfront costs. We recognize that, but we want to support ERB in their budget. We want to make this a functional agency. because we are mandated by state law to take our cases there. The task force met twice, made a recommendations. I will tell you that there was not 100% agreement on the recommendations that came forward for funding this. If there is going to be fees assessed, I believe that the task force did agree, you need to equally put those fees across both employers and employees so that you have an agency who is not dependent on one sole source of funding from the parties that are going to be before it.
Jim, several people have said the task force met twice. I served on a task force last interim that was dealing with a highly controversial set of issues, and we met interminably twice to work out a kind of complex series of what seemed to me to be management problems as well as funding problems. And do you feel, as a member of the task force, that the issue's got a thorough vetting in two meetings?
Madam Chairman,
I sound like I'm making a brief for more meetings to solve problems. I'm not.
Is there a per diem associated with that?
We'll sign him up, right?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I think there was a pretty good vetting of the issues. We knew what the issues were because Mr. Gamson had done his homework up front to get the information out, and so had Tom Chamberlain from the governor's office, to get the information out. And you have to take a look at the list of folks there. Mr. Gamson was the chair of it with Tom Chamberlain from the governor's office. You know, he's already overburdened at the agency, being the chair of the agency trying to make decisions, to have him come to more task force meetings. We were given voluminous amounts of information, and I can say to a person, everybody on that task force reviewed that. And one of the things I don't know if you got was recommendations from my association on how herb ought to be funded. If you didn't get that, I'll get you copies of that. It came from Ron Wilson, who is our associate executive director. He's the head of our labor relations department as well. He has 20-plus years of labor relations experience, and he made some recommendations. Obviously, they were part of the task force recommendations, but I think we had a fair opportunity, considering all the points with everybody around the table that needed to be there to discuss the issues around the agency. Obviously, state funding would be the best way to do it. If you can't do that, I'd encourage you to look at the task force recommendations that did come out, where there was agreement, and we know we need to fund this agency. We're willing to pay fees when we're filing or we're responding, and we wouldn't like to see higher fees, but if that needs to be in order to get this agency funded, we'll go that route. I think you heard that from the gentleman from that was just previously before me.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm coming into this issue lacking tremendous knowledge, so please accept that as I bring this question forward. Has there been discussion about just a fee for service? And then with any type of, and then I'm trying to think of the downside of a fee for service for the smaller communities, the imbalance, and then just having some type of mechanism where the loser pays the other's fees. I mean, why can't you do a fee-for-service like we do with the AG or someone else?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there was discussion about that at the task force. And I think you just hit on one of the main points, was where you have a small jurisdiction. If you make that fee prohibitive against either a small labor unit who's out there or a small employer, and you say it's going to be $5,000 to answer, to file a ULP, then you're really going to look at this and say, geez, can they afford to do that? We looked at the task force of saying, we know there has to be a general fund support for this, but we realize that the general fund isn't enough, and I think we're running into that scenario now. There is a fee assessment that needs to go along with that.
How does that David and Goliath scenario, how is that any different than what every small business owner in America has to deal with?
And Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's a good point, but remember one of the statements that I said here was you created this situation for which employers and employees have to bring their disputes forward. So what we're saying is you created a statutory mechanism. There should be state dollars that follow that. Obviously, there's going to be a user fee system. There already is. And when you look at the data, and I think you've heard some of that data, we're one of the highest. Some states don't have any fees for this type of service if it's provided or required at the state. And we're paying fees now. We understand that we want to have this agency funded. Look at the task force recommendations. I think you're going to hear folks in the room. I'm sure there's hackles going up on the back of their necks right now when I talk about that. But there were task force recommendations, and I would be happy to share that information that at least our association put forward. I know OEA also had some points that they made in opposition to ours, so you might want to ask Beth Ann Darby, who was a member of that task force, to supply that as well.
Thank you very much.
I am going to ask you, Mr. Green, to provide that, and I will also solicit or ask the professional staff to solicit Beth Ann Darby's material. But if you could provide that to the staff, they'll disseminate it. In the interest of time, any other questions for Mr. Green? And have you finished your testimony, Mr. Green?
Yes.
Any other questions for him? Thank you very much. Mr. Tucker, with apologies, I've moved you out of the queue, if you'd come forward.
No problem, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker. I'm with Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area, and my title is Legislative Affairs Manager, which puts me on the management side of the ledger, though I don't actually manage anybody. And I will be much less substantive and also much more brief, which I guess go together. The reason is that I'm here mainly just as a placeholder for our employment relations specialist, Kevin Dahl, who is out due to a death in his family. Otherwise, he'd be here to give you some much more substantive testimony. But he asked me to just go on the record in support of the IRBS budget, in support of making the budget whole. Metro's workers are represented predominantly by AFSCME, who you've already heard from today. We also have a couple of other unions that represent various workers that under our sort of umbrella of services we provide. Our main interest is that we've predominantly that we've used the mediation services that the IRB provides. So I'm just here to go on record in general support of the budget, and as to Senator Morse's questions, I believe Kevin actually may have some thoughts on those matters, but I would get him in touch with you if you're interested in hearing from him when he gets back.
We would invite whatever written testimony to become part of the record. The way that this is going today, we will not be moving this budget, and so it will leave ample opportunity for additional information to come into the record.
That's all I had to say, Madam Chair.
Be gentle with him. He's a placeholder.
Yes, I'd be glad to relay any questions to somebody who actually could answer them and get back to you with answers.
It's good seeing you. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Your statement generated a question for anyone out in the audience who will grab me at some point in time and provide me with an answer. Have we looked at quantifying the savings of mediation? And so if someone could share that with me in the future. Thank you.
Heads are going up and down, and Ms. Botkin looks like she might pop if she doesn't get invited up. Would you like to come up and comment?
Good seeing you, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. This puts you hideously on the spot.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm actually a little embarrassed. I didn't even know about the task force recommendations until 5 minutes ago, and I now have a copy of them and will review them and will prepare some written responses to them. I don't know if it's possible for us to put a dollar and cents figure on the savings that are created through effective labor management relationships and through mediation and conciliation services provided by IRB. I can tell you that anecdotally, I've been in this building a long time, unfortunately.
It's called experience.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want the subcommittee to take this in the wrong way, but there is an alternative to a lack of arbitrations. It's called a strike. There's an alternative to lack of mediation services. It's called work stoppages. You know, those are the real realities. And when we put together PECPA a bazillion years ago, Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, it was determined that what we should be doing is working towards labor peace, not labor unrest. And it was put together in a carefully constructed manner so that there were a series of opportunities to resolve labor disputes in the least offensive and least conflictive manner. When I was a rep, you know, doing sort of the grievances and all of those things, I can tell you there are times when I work with members who would much rather have walked off the job than to have stayed there and done their work because we forced them to go into mediation services. That is the other side of the coin. And, you know, when we talk about lost productivity, you know, it's easier to talk about it when you have a crisis. When you have a private contractor who digs through a water main in Washington County and eliminates water services for a third of the county, it's easier to say it's cheaper if we have, you know, Water Bureau boys come fix it because they know how to fix it. How do you quantify the savings that creates? If that occurs and there's nobody there to answer the call, then I think that you can start, you know, adding up the costs associated to both the citizens and the businesses and everybody else. As far as fees go, we suggested fees. This wasn't some divine intervention on the part of the legislature in some former committee that said, oh, I know, let's charge fees. We came in and said, you know, maybe we ought to pay some small fees in order to preserve some of the very crucial pieces of herb that we all agree we need. It was something that labor management came in here together and suggested. And it was not an easy decision to make, because I think that there is always the question about fairness and the judicial responsibility of this board. And I think that we need to figure out whether or not we want this board to make judicial decisions without influence. You know, OEA is twice as big as we are. Does that mean they get better decisions in their school boards and their school districts because they pay more fees than we do? Does that mean that we do better than, you know, some small engineering union? Because there are very small engineering unions. How about the printers union? They're very small. Do we just simply run over them and say, sorry, you boys can't pay, you're on your own? I mean, this makes no sense to me. And we just need to really think about how we're going to fund the agency through a mixture, and that, I think, is how we saw it occurring, was a mixture of general fund and fee supports for those agencies and those unions which utilize the services.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful testimony. The question I'm going to ask in no way reflects on Mr. Gamson, who has inherited a series of problems. So with that disclaimer, Mary, you're probably the keenest observer of some of this stuff in the building. And the question that I have for you...
I'm not sure that's a compliment.
No, it is. I'm drawing on your unique expertise to answer the question I'm going to pose to you. We've heard some very compelling testimony that suggests to me that there are some necessary tools missing from the agency. But it also seems that there are some management issues at the agency. If I saw this in a business, it would send up some flags to me. Extremely high turnover, missing essential tools. A fairly inefficient operation, and I don't know how far back somebody said, gee, I think we've got a problem here. We don't have a research library that's adequate to the task. Caseloads, if you look in the performance measures, taking longer and longer and longer to handle. Beyond just throwing more money at ERB, are there some fundamental management problems that you think need to be fixed at the agency?
I think if there were, they've retired. Part of me is being pretty serious about that. You know, there was never a time in my career in this building when I thought Rita Thomas and I would ever be on the same side of anything. You know, she was, you know, in my view, she was Gene Durfler's puppet. You know what? Never say never. Because what we figured out was labor disputes don't help anybody. And I thought it was the curse of the dragons to have Rita placed on ERB. I thought it was really sort of the final twist of fate. And I think that Rita has done an incredible job prior to Paul trying to manage this agency. It was Rita who called and said, "We are in so much trouble. Let me show you." And that was two and a half years ago. And, you know, it just never occurred to me to not help. When Paul called, it didn't occur to me to not help again and to not have my colleagues who deal with this every day come forward and talk about their experiences with ERB. You know, I think that this is an agency, if it was mismanaged, it's been a long time ago. I think these folks are just scrambling to keep up. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to see in front of the battle when all you have is smoke between you and the lines. And I think that at this point, the agency needs a breath to catch up and to figure out how to get there and whether or not there's a way to do that. You know, I'm not a management consultant. I'm not a management. I have no ability to manage much more than just my own workload. So
we have a queue. Representative Smith, then Representative Vakia.
I'll defer to Representative Avakian.
Representative Avakian.
If you just very briefly comment, Mr. Gamson, when you come up, you as well, on the sentiment, and I'm not implying at all that it's shared by this committee, but I know it is by some, that if the unions just stopped threatening to strike so much and stopped causing so much trouble, we wouldn't have so many disputes and we'd be able to handle the workload.
Who has suggested that?
Besides my friend Lars.
I'd agree with that on the record.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Avakian.
My statement doesn't surprise you, I assume.
You know, Lars's idea of a democratic workforce is one in which he gets to decide what democracy is. And so, you know, I can't respond to his allegations. I can tell you that labor disputes and labor strikes have not increased. They've decreased. That is a testament to the talents of the people who are sitting behind me, both from my side of the table as well as from management's side of the table. It is a testament to the quality of the workers that we have who really are willing to sort of suck it up and take whatever the mediators decide on and what is eventually put before them to vote on. You know, I think that threats are a long ways away from reality. You know, when I first came to work in the labor movement, my boss told me, and he's long since moved along, but my boss at the time told me that anybody can take a unit out on strike. It takes talent and forethought to bring them back to work. And that really is, a good union negotiator never takes a unit out on strike without a plan to get back in. And, you know, you don't do that by blowing up the bridge. You just simply threaten to. And, you know, ERB is the agency with the people who have sort of the fresh outlook and can come in and help you see solutions that you didn't see before. Or in some cases, you know, Wendy Greenwald is one of those people who is a mediator who can, over a slow and meticulous process, beat you into submission.
With a wet noodle.
Actually, you know, I think sleep deprivation has been one of her...
You know, that's a tactic that works well here towards the end of a session.
You know, but I think that if you, you know, when you walk away and everybody feels like they either won or they lost, then you know you've got a pretty good deal. You know, you don't want to go away feeling, with one side feeling like it was totally abused in the system or the process, or the other side. And I think that, you know, when you look at the history of this agency with very limited resources, they've done a very good job. And I know that the committee's trying to get through this, and so unless you have any other questions, I won't.
Representative Smith, and then we are going to move on.
Okay. Thank you. Again, good morning, Mary. Good seeing you.
Good morning, sir.
Once again, I come into this lacking a lot of knowledge. But to me, it seems like being that the legislature is the board and the governor is the chair of the board, that the ERT serves almost as an insurance policy, if you will, in helping to make sure that in the event there is a dispute between labor and management, that rather than throwing this whole thing out, you have someone to come in between. And so, you know, I think about the 2.9 million in the recommended budget, 1.5 general fund, 1.3 other. To me, that seems like a cost of doing business, if you will, in ensuring that you keep folks working. I think back 30 years ago to the Gresham School District when they went on strike for, almost 3 weeks, you know, not only did you have the lost wages, but just think of the lost wages to the vendors and suppliers in what at that time was a very small community. And, you know, to have a mechanism like this in place to help avoid those type of situations, to me, seems like a fiscally prudent move to have this, and I guess I'm just still working through this.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think you actually have your thumb right on the pulse of this, is that this really is a problem-solving agency, mm-hmm. and I think it's really important to remember, you know what, the City of Portland, we don't, you know, AFSCME in the City of Portland, we don't need ERB to step in between us. We have enough talent in that area that we can probably handle this. If Wendy wasn't available on a mediation, we could probably find somebody to do it for us. You know, we could do that. But think about some place like Huntington. You know, they have 5 employees. You know, this is some place where once bad feelings are created, it'll be 3 generations before people forget, if we're lucky.
Forgive. 5 to forget. I know Huntington.
Okay, I mean, you know, these are the small units of government, and the smaller unions are the ones that need the services that ERP provides the most. And so, and they're the least able to pay. And so the question is, how do we fund it? And, again, I will look over this task force recommendation. I'll get back to you either individually or as a committee.
I would prefer that you, if you do have a work product, that you make it available to the whole committee. That certainly isn't to discourage you from talking to folks, but no. If there's a written response.
And I'll make sure staff has it as well.
Great. Thank you very much. That was very helpful. We went way over the allotted time for testimony, but I think that this was a very important exchange. Mr. Gamson, thank you for your patience. I'd invite you back up. And Satish, thank you. We have 20 more minutes left for the high-level overview, and also to leave enough time for Satish to go through his presentation. So, Mr. Gamson, let's go for 15 more minutes. We'll try to restrain the questions. We'll leave 5 for Satish.
First, I'd like to say that the state conciliators here in the room, if there are continued questions or if there is specific data that you would like us to provide, we can do that. I'd like to address 2 or 3 things that came out in the testimony, and I'll go through them actually really quite briefly. Increasing fees, one of the things the task force looked at when there were suggestions about fees and increasing fees is the impact on usage that prior fees had. And there were no fees, I believe, until either 1993 or 1995. My dates are off a little bit. But there was a precipitous drop, 50% drop in usage. And it's hard. There wasn't really anything else that we could attribute it to. The timing was almost precise when the usage dropped off, and the feeling of I won't speak for all of the task force committee members, but certainly of some, was that we don't want to do things that are going to discourage people from getting their disputes resolved. And any significant fee increase, at least for some small communities, apparently has that effect. There was a brief mention about online decisions and the agency's decisions, and at this point, I don't know if it's actually up yet, but we have worked very hard with the Oregon State Bar, at least, so that our decisions will be on their website with a searchable database.
Just really quick.
Representative Spinner.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning.
To me, that just it makes sense that there ought to be some type of issue paper or position statement that's sent out to employers and to the labor folks, letting them know of decisions as they've come down. And I assume that's what you're talking about with something online, or is that different?
No, that's it would be, as I understand it, they're going to scan all of our cases into their database going back to 1973,
really,
and
quick.
It would be a searchable database.
Isn't there a way, though, of just having like a one-page position, you know, here was the issue, here was the key points, here was the outcome?
There are some services actually that do that. We don't do that as an agency. What we do, you know, and the number exactly escapes me, but every time we issue a decision, there's 20 or 30 groups that we send out all decisions to. Major employers, major employer groups, major labor unions, and other people who request them. So there's, we've always done that kind of a notification, but this is the first online thing that we've done. I guess the bigger picture issue that I would like to at least take an attempt at addressing is what's apparently a notion that it's a choice between either, for example, spending $200,000 for an extra teacher or police officer, or spending the money on us. And I frankly think that's a false choice. And here's the reason why. If we slow down our decisions, and I think when I looked in preparation for this at our performance measures, we have gone, comparing 2002 to 2004, from start to finish on a case is about 100 days slower. And here's what that will mean, especially to employers in a case that involves back pay. It means that they're going to have to pay an additional 100 days worth of back pay. Now, we recently had a case that came out of the Portland School District where 300 janitors were laid off, and it was a potential back pay case. And as it turned out, it was a 2-to-1 vote to uphold the layoff. But if one vote, and I'm just using this as an example of one case, if one vote had been different and had voted to reinstate these employees with back pay, there would have been 300-plus people with back pay coming to them, and if the decision took 100 days longer, it would be 100 days of back pay for 300 people.
Really quick. Senator Johnson. That goes back to my question about issuing some type of position paper. If I'm finding out that that issue is going on in another area, and I perhaps have that same issue, that's going to give me a lot of direction on what I ought to be doing. And if I'm a manager in a small little community, or a manager of in a small little community, I may not be as prideful, if you will, to take the position I'm going to take and to get my council with me or my board with me, knowing that at the end the decision may be there. Or at the same time, a labor group may say, yeah, this is something that, you know, we've tried to pursue two or three times and it hasn't worked out. And so I think there's a way to share the knowledge.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I actually, you know, earlier when you asked me how the information is available, I, for whatever reason, totally neglected to say that online on our website. As within a couple of days as we publish recommended decisions and then ultimately publish final decisions, issue them. They're available online. So anybody who goes to our website can simply click on, I think it's called recent board decisions, and they can go and see what's been decided, often literally within the last week.
Perfect. Thank you.
And we tend to go back about a year on those. Okay. So I guess the point I was making is that if we're understaffed, if we don't have the tools, and as a consequence act more slowly, it's not without cost. And it may, in fact, what I'm saying, for back pay awards being one example, it may, in fact, end up costing local government more than the $200,000 they may have gotten for that teacher. That $200,000, however it works around, may end up being additional money paid for a back pay award. And there actually is one other thing that I want to say about that. If we don't have sufficient administrative law judges, it may come to me, and I have been considering this, I may have to tell them that they can't travel. And what that would mean for local government, if there was a case, you know, with, for example, we just heard a case from the Enterprise School District. And our role has always been, instead of Enterprise School District having to bring 10 teachers and an attorney and administrators to us in Salem, we send one person out there. But when we send one person out there, it's a day of travel and a day of hearing and another day of travel. And if I really don't have the resources, from my point of view, the most efficient thing for me to do is tell you, you have to come to Salem. And that gives me, instead of one day of hearing and 2 days travel, I have three productive days. And that is going to be a way that I am likely going to have to capture some of the scarce resources that I have. And in the end, it's a cost shifting. It's going to shift costs to local government when they have to pay to bring people overnight. And I will tell you, we've always been very conscious of not interrupting or doing as best we can to not interrupt work. So if we have 10 employees queued up to testify, we will have one person there, maybe one person in the gallery waiting to testify, and the rest of the people will stay at work until they get their call. And if they have to travel, so they may, the whole ordeal may be for each person maybe 1 hour of missed work, but if they have to come over from Eastern Oregon, for example, instead of 1 hour, everybody's going to end up spending 3 days. And it's simply a shift of costs between the back pay and what I think is likely a travel issue. Okay. There was a question that I was asked to address about unions stop agitating, and I'm not sure. I certainly am not going to, as a neutral decision maker, not going to take a position in favor of or against unions. What I will say is that however the agitation works out, in the last biennium there was only one strike, so I'm not sure what you call agitation, and I think it's probably important to look at who it is that's calling it agitation. It's probably not the person who is feeling put upon, it's the person who is feeling the brunt of it. So one person's agitation may be another person's feeling that I'm not being treated fairly. There's some very serious injustice, and if it doesn't get settled, it's going to have some consequences. So I don't know how to answer that other than to say agitation is a point of view. And another person would probably see the same activities as simply trying to get workplace fairness. I really am open to be directed as to, with the short time, as to what would be most useful.
Well, I think maybe in the last, we've interrupted you so many times, I'm not sure that you could have kept a comprehensive flow to your presentation. I apologize for that. In the remaining minutes, maybe just open this up to additional questions that the panel has. And I would start by asking, going back to my question about how the agency has been managed prior. If I understood you correctly, when the last reduction was made and you lost, as you characterized it, 25% of the workforce, two of those positions had incumbents. Two were vacant.
That's my understanding.
We had a mediator's position vacant and our transcriber's position vacant. We had held it to fund.
Would you come up and identify yourself for the record, please?
Madam Chair, could they discuss the timing when those vacancies were in place and so forth?
Sure, because what I'm trying to get to is the underlying question. If things were so gruesome and there were two open positions, why weren't they filled?
Senator Johnson, members of the committee, I'm Rita Thomas. I've been on the board for 7.5 years. The mediator's position had been a position that we have felt for many years needed to be funded, but had not been funded for many years. And I think that State Conciliator Wendy Greenwald was hanging on to that as long as she could. We were not able to fund that for the whole time I was on the board. The transcriber's position had not been filled. The chair of the board at that time was David Steitler. He was chair of the board for 7 years. And it's my understanding that he held the position open for about 12 months because he needed that money during that biennium to fund the remaining positions that we had. About the time that we were coming into finishing the 2003 session, DAS came down with a position that we could not hire, and I think he was prepared to fill that position, but we couldn't hire at that point. So we had basically two positions that were open at that time.
And what happened to those? The positions were both gobbled back up or by the legislature, or did I understand you to say that one of them was used to fund other positions?
Chair Johnson, one of them was used to fund other positions during that biennium.
So that position, I think in the nomenclature of state government, you burned that position in order to reclass up other positions?
Well, nothing actually got reclassed, but and I wasn't chair of the board at that time, so I'm not fully aware of where all the money was going, but I know that he was holding that position open, hoping to maintain enough just to run the agency, including things like, I did want to answer a question about the books and the research tool, because I don't want you to think that we've been woefully unable to do research. During the 2003 session, it's my understanding that Chair Steitler, who had been chair for 7 years, had decided to go to LexisNexis, and he did not order books for 2003 to continue to grow that hard copy library. And he, as Chair Gamson has said, chose to resign along with another board member, leaving me as the last man standing, so to speak. So I became sort of a temporary interim board chair, did not want to being it permanently, but he did have intentions of creating LexisNexis, and it took us about a year to get that online, and I'm not sure how Chair Gamson's funding it, but it's a vital tool. We absolutely need it for the agency.
Why would it take a year to get LexisNexis online?
I'm not sure.
I can't speak to that. I can only tell you that it was one of my priorities, and in the last, I don't know, six months or so, we've had it.
Pulled it up, yeah.
Representative Krupp and then Representative.
Thank you. I'm unclear about the timing of the vacant positions. Can you provide us specifically when those positions were first vacant? That's important for us in determining the veracity of the need here. And there seems to be a significant need, at least from what I've heard here today. At the same time, if the need has been magnified because positions were held vacant for other reasons, then we need to examine the reasons why those positions were held vacant priorly and then try to make some determination about how we fix the problem here. And so the timing issue is unclear to me. I'd like to have some clarification on that, if you could, please. Thank you.
Senator Johnson and Representative Croft, I can tell you that one of the reasons the transcriber's position was not filled was that we had a full-time trained paralegal on staff who was typing like crazy, and she was doing a lot of the transcription. She was also the board secretary and doing a variety of other jobs. When we came to the legislature last in 2003, we had proposed to cut two positions, and I think the chair at that time was giving away the transcriber position, believing that we would continue to have
this paralegal position. However, that was one of the four positions that was cut in 2003. So instead of two positions being lost, we lost four. And I think that we can give you a summary of that in a short.
That would be very helpful if you wouldn't mind happened. Preparing a little summary with the dates.
And Madam Chair, one last point here. When you're talking about adding transcription services, the audit recommended a limited duration position to do that. Could you get more done if you just contracted out to an outside entity the transcription service? So in other words, could we, for the same amount of money, could we get something done by contracting out to the private sector, get more accomplished? See, this seems to be a bottleneck for everyone, and it is a significant concern to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Cross, because it has not, because neither have been a possibility, frankly, I have not looked into which way would be the most efficient. My understanding of the governor's recommended budget is that it's not for a position, that it's for cash. It's for $12,000 to be used for transcription services. The amount of money would be insufficient to hire a person, so my view is that we would contract it out.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm still struggling, not with the quality of the board or what you do. What I'm struggling with is at this point is how we're paying for this. What would be wrong again with a sliding scale? I understand the argument that small communities, it may place a burden on them, but I step back and I think about it. If I'm the mayor or the city manager of the city of Ione with 250 people, excuse me, and I'm having to pay a fee, to me, again, it's like an insurance policy. I may not have to use this for 10, 15 years, but the first time I do, it's cheaper to know that I have a relations board I can turn to rather than having to put 50-50 of a private arbitrator that I could be having to contract with for a year or taking this to court and losing altogether. What am I'm missing something here on why we can't be passing this fee on to the folks who are benefiting from this. What am I missing?
I don't know if you're missing anything. It's the issue that the task force took up and looked at and decided that it was not a good way. I will tell you quite frankly that, how do I say this, in order to feel like we can maintain our neutrality, the best way is for the money to come from the state, because as soon as the money starts coming from interest groups who appear in front of us, and first time we issue a decision that they don't like, there's going to be pressure on taking money away from us. And I wouldn't recommend that any more than I would recommend funding state courts in the same way. It seems like it would that there were, you know, inevitably there, when there's money, what follows is going to be political pressure for certain results.
But if I lose, I have to pay court fees. If I'm taken to court or I go to court and I lose, I potentially could have to pay court fees.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, actually both in Oregon, it's called the American rule. The American rule is that each side pays its own, and there are some statutory exceptions to that, but for the most part, when you get sued, it's out of your own pocket. At the end of the day, what it cost you is what it cost you to appear in court.
Thank you.
We are
speaking.
Go ahead, Ms. Thomas.
Chair Johnson and Representative Smith. I just one thing it's important to remember is that these are public employees, and these public employees, by virtue of the state and federal constitution, have rights that private employees don't have. And I've done quite a bit of work in the prisons, as doing prison ministry as a volunteer. And it dawned on me this weekend that by virtue of the Constitution, inmates have significant rights to hearings, grievance procedures. And that's free to them. And that's considered public policy under our Constitution. And what we've quibbled about for a number of years since I've been on the board is it the public policy of the state
to how do we fund the grievance procedure for public employees. And traditionally, most states have funded it through general funding. And that's a struggle here.
Lacking knowledge. I'm not questioning, just trying to gain greater information.
We are out of time, and I don't think have... I appreciated the witness testimony very much. It was very helpful. I let it go longer than I had intended. So we have missed some of the rest of your presentation, Mr. Gamson, particularly performance measures. I will be working with legislative, fiscal, and Satish, I apologize to you. We never even got to you.
Well, you have my presentation material.
Thank you. We'll be working with legislative, fiscal, to try to figure out a time prior to the panel actually working the budget when we can have a discussion of your performance measures, because I think that's going to be critical to figuring out what to do with this budget. So I apologize for running us up against the time deadline, and unless there are any other comments from the panel, I am going to close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5025 and declare us adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning.
You know.